You wanted the best and you got it. The hottest band in the land, KISS!
Greetings, everyone. Patrick here. This is the beginning of a long-rumored and finally coming to fruition week here on Rockin' the Suburbs. We are going to do the Big Five KISS album. So this is KISS week. I'm calling on a very dear friend of mine, a guy I've played music with for many decades and have known since back in the 90s. It's David Bishop, 80s. Known to you all as 80s. Bish. 80s, that's right, depending on the origin story. That's right, it was the 80s. Bish, how are you, man?
I'm doing well, Mr. Pat.
Thank you very much for taking the time to be here with me. I really appreciate it. We're going to start here with, I think, the album that is, well, it's definitely my favorite. And is it also your favorite KISS album, Bish?
Yeah, it's definitely the one that started it for me, and definitely the one that got me hooked. And I was trying, I've been going back through the timeline and trying to figure out exactly when I bought it and all that.
Yep.
And
yep.
So I'm sure you've been trying to do the same.
I've been trying, but yeah, it's hazy going back to the early days. But So without further ado, folks, it's Alive by KISS. And let me set up a couple facts here. And this first fact is actually the whole impetus behind doing KISS Week at the time we're doing it. The album was released on September 10th,
yes.
1975. So yes. That is 45. We just, as we record this, Bish, that was 2 days past the 45th anniversary of the release of Alive. So
it's amazing. How many years?
45 years.
45.
We're old. It's the band's fourth album, all released on Casablanca Records up to this point. The record went to number 9 on the charts and stayed on the charts for 110 weeks.
Wow, that's ridiculous.
We'll talk about the single from the record, I'm sure, a little bit later. You know, those are kind of the main background facts. You know, I talked about the chart position. I will say this, the first three KISS albums, which were the self-titled debut, Hotter Than Hell, and Dressed to Kill, they all sold, I guess, in the range of 100,000 to 150,000. So immediately, Alive took the band into a completely different sphere. They were popular in pockets. They were popular in the Midwest. They had toured a ton with bands like Rush and Origin.
Which is so funny. The Rush stories, it's like...
It's great.
Which is funny for me because, you know, I went from... like one extreme to the other extreme. After I was done with KISS, it was Rush. And you've got, you know, you go, seriously, you go from like these simple pop songs to these huge mammoth song, you know, long, you know, where the lyrics actually, hello, matter and stuff like that. So
that's really, really interesting. Yeah. And let's talk about our origin stories with Alive and the band. When did you first hear it and kind of how it came into your life?
So I got to go back to my notes trying to figure out exactly when this was. So this is fifth grade. This is 1976 for me.
Okay.
So Alive had been out for a year or whatever. And so, but I was 11 years old at the time and I was starting to get into KISS. I had a friend, his name was John Hansen. But he, and so I think Destroyer had come out. I think KISS had just like toured or whatever. And we were starting to, he was into him because of his older brother. And his older brother had gone to like, I think the Destroyer show. And he had brought home the concert booklet, you know.
Wow.
And it was like, man, it was almost like, you know, as treasured as maybe a Playboy back then or something, because it was so cool. It was, you know, no bands were doing this. No bands had the theatrics and all that stuff. So I think I bought Alive sometime in the summer of 76. So Destroyer had been out. Right.
Right.
But then the thing that I really remember is the Paul Lynde special. Which was which was October of 76, right? And I think that was, then it was all over for me. I was just, you know, hooked. So I had turned 11 at right around that time. So, and I was also trying to think of the first time I went and saw him around that time. You know, I saw him three times. I think the first time we saw him was on the Love Gun tour. And here's the amazing part. When you look back on this, those years seemed, I look back on them now, it seemed like it must have been like a 6 or 7 year period. But I look back on it now, I was only into him for about 3 years.
Right.
And all that. And I think of all the money that I spent on the paraphernalia and all that. So yeah, I bought Alive, and this is typical of me. I didn't buy Destroyer, even though it had had Detroit Rock City, which I thought was great. I had the single of Detroit Rock City, but I didn't buy Destroyer because I loved Rock and Roll All Night, of course. And this Live album had so many more songs. And if I just spent a couple bucks more, I could get that many more songs. So, you know, but then, you know, we'll get into the inside. Once you bought the record and took it home, what was your origin story? It was your first Kiss record too, right?
It was. And, you know, just like you, I spent a lot of time this week sort of thinking about, you know, it's a very vivid memory in my mind, but I can't remember exactly when that memory was. But as far as I can remember, it was the same year that you discovered him too. So I remember, I think it was Thanksgiving of 1976. I'm pretty sure we went to my cousin's house, and just like you were saying, and my cousin Robert and Brooke were, I think, like 3 years older than me. One of them was, and it was my cousin Robert who had the album in it, and I'm holding up here for those of you watching on VH1 too.
Is that your original copy?
This is my original copy.
You are so lucky, man.
It's beat to crap. And look at this. I've duct taped it like 3 or 4 times, the gatefold. Yeah.
So,
but I remember sitting on his floor in the bedroom, like before Thanksgiving dinner. You know, the kids would always get together and like go somewhere, right?
Yeah.
But he was like, "Oh, you got to hear this album." And these letters, I remember I was holding the album, looking at these letters and being so scared. Like, I couldn't believe these people were real and they were playing this rock and roll music that was so
raucous. Did he have the magazine, though?
I don't remember looking at the magazine. He may have had it.
The insert.
I just remember staring at these letters going, "Gene Simmons, Dear Victims."
Yeah, Dear Victims.
Oh, my God.
And what was Ace Frehley? Dear Star Children or something like
Dear Earthlings.
Earthlings, yeah.
The gravity on Earth isn't quite the same as it is on my planet. So I was freaked out, man. Yeah. And, you know, it was incredible. Then on the back, of course, a picture of these two guys holding the Kiss poster how long have you stared at that? I stared at it today.
It's amazing. It's amazing.
Yeah.
You know, I think
it's
such
a snapshot of,
didn't they find those guys like 20 or 30 years later and
they
all
did.
That?
Yeah. And there were rumors too. I always heard the rumor like later that, oh, that wasn't even taken at a Kiss concert, man. Those guys were so into Kiss, it was at a different concert.
No kidding.
I think that's been debunked by the guys. Yeah, they were like, no, it was a Kiss concert.
Well,
why would we hold that sign up at a different concert?
So they were huge in Detroit. That's from Detroit, right? And so I think you talk about that Midwest vibe.
Yeah.
And really, come on, Detroit is not the Midwest.
But you bring up an interesting point, Bish, because in my reading about this, two things I want to point out, and I took this from a book written by the excellent author Julian Gill, and confirmed in other places. The album's title was a homage to the 1972 live album Slade Alive from Slade, who were obviously a big influence on Kiss.
Oh,
right?
That is so cool.
When the album was reissued, and so it's been reissued a couple times in a box set, but also it came out on a CD. It was made much more clear when the songs were actually recorded, at least the basics of the songs. But the majority does come from May 16th, 1975 at Cobo Arena in Detroit. Then June 21 in Cleveland Music Hall, July 20th, Orpheum Theater, Davenport, Iowa. And then July 23rd, Wildwoods Convention Center in Wildwood, New Jersey. So just to give you guys a really quick background, Kiss's label at the time, Casablanca, was in deep trouble financially. This was before disco and the Village People and Donna Summer and all that had hit. They had Kiss had basically gotten no royalties at all. And so this was kind of a last ditch effort for Casablanca. They said, hey, we don't have money to send you into the studio. We can't give you an advance, but what about, let's try a live album. And before this, Kiss's manager, Bill O'Coin, actually had sent a letter to Casablanca's president, Neil Bogart, and said, we're going to break the contract because you haven't paid us any money, you know, from all these, three albums we've done. They sold, you know, some copies and we've seen nothing. And so they wanted out of the contract, and it looked like the company was going to go under. And Alive ended up saving them when it became such a huge seller and, you know, captured kind of something that those first three studio albums did not capture. And, I mean, interestingly enough, Bill O'Coin, again, he actually paid for the entire tour, according to stories and records here, out of his own pocket, at which Alive was recorded, $300,000 of his own money to keep Kiss on the road. And this is when they recorded these shows.
Wow.
And it was quite a long time before the members of the band actually admitted, right, that they went into the studio and overdubbed a whole bunch of stuff on it.
Right. I mean, so let's yeah. All right. Let's get that out front.
Yeah.
Does that bother you?
It doesn't bother me.
That
I mean,
doesn't bother me in the least at all, because and even if I'd been told that at the time, I don't think I would have cared. I was 11 years old, so what would I know?
Right. It doesn't matter to me.
It didn't. Yeah, it didn't matter. And I go back to thinking about that time. That time you and I were 6 months apart.
Yep.
I think, or something like that.
10 or 11 years old. Yeah.
We had no chance. We had no chance against them. No. Our parents didn't have a chance against them either. There was no. My mom could, you know, she could have said all she wanted. I wasn't going to listen to her. I was going to be a Kiss fan, period.
Yeah.
And because we were the target audience, that 11, perfect. 10, 11, yep. 12 year old kids, whether they were really trying at the time. I mean, once they hit that merchandise wheel, man, it was like I could not buy enough posters. You know, we stood no chance. To me, you either loved them or there were a lot of people that didn't like them. You know, back
yeah.
then. But for me, it was like, oh, I found it. I found this, the greatest thing ever. You know.
Yeah, you found Nirvana, and suddenly you found like music that connected with you. It's like a cool
way. No, hold on. Now, so that's just like at the time. This is the weird dichotomy of going from Kiss to Rush. I never really thought much about the Kiss lyrics and how offensive they were. You know, I really
me neither.
I never did at that time. I wasn't, you know, fifth grader. I didn't. I was barely listening to the lyrics. I was, you know, I knew all the songs. I knew all the lyrics, but I didn't know I didn't sit back and go, what are they talking about? You know, I didn't think twice about that. And then switching over a couple years later and being into Rush, I was like, wow, what the hell are they talking? You know, I was really into the lyrics.
I'll tell you this, man. Such a great point you make, because I remember, you know, maybe a year later, couple years later, when I was really, I remember having an argument with someone who was like, dude, the song Rock and Roll All Night, they don't say probably every day, they say party every day, and Kiss parties hard, man. They use drugs and they drink a lot. I'm like, no way, Kiss does not drink. You know, they're musicians, they can't do that, they don't party. The other interesting thing I think about Alive, what an advertisement it was for the other albums.
Yeah,
I mean, look in the inside, it's just more Kiss. And there are the three albums that you had no idea even existed.
Yeah.
that was the impetus to buy all the originals.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Those three originals. Yeah. And so, talking briefly about Rock and Roll All Night, that was the single from the record, the live version. It was a top 20 hit. It went to number 12 in late 75. So, it probably still is the only Kiss song. Well, there's maybe a ballad that occasionally might get played on the radio, but probably one of the two or three Kiss songs that gets played on the radio even today.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It was Rock and Roll All Night. Yeah.
Yeah. That's always going to be played on your Labor Day countdowns on your classic rock stage. I go back to this booklet. I don't know. I can't tell you how many hours I spent looking at the booklet. And I'm looking right now at the center set of pictures. And I remember looking at that for the first time and I saw, oh, wow, dude's breathing fire and all this. And I look over and I see this one picture and it's Simmons with this blood coming out. I'm like, oh, my God. God, that is disgusting. And then, a couple weeks later, that is so cool.
I don't know about you. I did buy the fake blood. I had the tubes of fake blood and the Kiss blood that you go in the bathroom and lock the door and pretend to breathe. I did. And look at myself in the mirror and pretend to spit blood like Gene Simmons. It was cool, man. Because it just kind of leaked out of the corners of his mouth. Why don't we play something here off the album? Let's listen to the beginning of the record.
Right on.
This is the very famous introduction to Alive.
Yeah.
You wanted the best and you got it. The hottest band in the land, Kiss!
No, that's such a great song, but you know, and you go back to the Slade stuff, right?
Yep.
And and now that you say that, there is a little bit of link to that. But at the time, and I didn't know what glam rock was in 11th grade and all that, but at the time, there was like this cool record store down in Joplin, Missouri that I'd go to that had tons of singles. And at the time, during that time, I was picking up all the sweet singles, Action, yeah. Ballroom Blitz, Love Is Like Oxygen, all those songs, that's you know, typical glam rock and all that. And I never thought of Kiss as glam rock, but, you know, they're not too far removed.
Certainly. And, you know, we'll probably talk later in this week when we talk about another album or two, the influence of the New York Dolls on Kiss when they were starting. I mean, you know, in the early 70s, this is kind of, I mean, you hear it there, right, Bish? It's like street rock, man.
Yeah.
It's stripped down. The guitar is like stabbing. There's those breaks in there.
There's a connection to punk rock.
Oh, yeah.
I went through this period, right? And I was thinking, when was the period where you couldn't get rid of your Kiss records fast enough at the used record store, you know? There was a great used record store down the street from us. And I remember being there like shortly after I started driving, like in 81, and you would just see bins of Kiss.
Yeah.
The old Kiss records, you know, and you're like, I didn't sell them fast enough.
I
know.
I think you said it right. You know, with your move to Rush, there was a period where you're like, oh my God, like, why was I ever into this kid stuff? And, you know, it seems kind of dumb. I'm glad I was as OCD as I am and hung on to him. But
my parents put up a black cork, made one of my walls in my bedroom a black cork wall, right? Because they knew I was, because that's at the high point of posters, Farrah right. Fawcett, et cetera. And
better than my wall, which had like 80,000 thumbtack holes.
Yeah,
in it.
Yeah. So they knew what they. It was really smart of them because I was
very smart.
I'd switch out. I had so many Kiss posters. I was switching them out like weekly and stuff like that. You know,
cut stuff out of magazines and all that. Yeah,
I must have spent. I must have had it one time. Probably spent $100 in the Kiss. You remember that they had the giant 6-foot Kiss posters.
I remember those. Yeah. I remember the poster too that came out in the bicentennial year of 76 where they were sort of recreating, you know.
Oh,
the,
that was sort so of famous. Great. Yes.
Yeah, that was kind of, yes. They had the, yeah. You know, the Revolutionary War soldiers there.
Yeah, that was so awesome.
That was a very American
thing. Was that the one, if you remember back to like the first episode of WKRP in Cincinnati. Yeah. Like yeah, exactly. that's the poster
that's right.
Gary puts up on the, you know, and it's like everybody's like, oh my God.
Mission statement. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a little different. There's something interesting that the author Julian Gill, what he writes is the album is Kiss Alive rather than Kiss Live. And this subtle play on words is a useful way to look at the album. It's more than semantics. The album is a patchwork, almost an audio quilt of many different parts of assorted shows recorded on the Dress to Kill tour, plus extensive overdubs. And then Eddie Kramer, who was the producer on the record, says, who cares if it was overdubbed? So what? It doesn't matter. The energy still came through, all the bombast, all the glory, and the craziness. And I will tell you that the record sold 500,000 copies by the end of the year. So it was gold by the end of 1975. And that means
like 2.5 months or 3.5 months.
Amazing.
Right.
It just exploded out of the box. It saved Casablanca's record label.
Wait a minute. Are you saying that we helped disco?
Help create disco.
Yeah.
You and I, just listening to you talk earlier, Bish, we saw Kiss on the same tour. We saw them on Love Gun in 77. That was the second concert I'd ever seen in my life. They put on such a spectacular show with pyrotechnics and flash pots and, right. You know, all that stuff that, sure, you're bound to make mistakes, right? It's not like you're standing there precisely trying to play all the notes. So there was stuff that had to be covered up. But I think the band essentially felt, well, you know what? we've never really captured the energy that was happening. Like, people, when they went to the early Kiss shows, really connected with the band because of the makeup, because of the theatrics, because of the energy, because of the freewheeling style, street rock and all that. But they never captured it really on the first three albums, despite their charms.
We talked about this earlier. As no effect on me. It's still awesome.
Yeah.
If you had told me that at 11, I wouldn't have gotten it. I wouldn't have understood that.
Partly, too, think about when you and I, 80s, mid to late 80s, and started getting into indie rock and understanding stuff like, wait a minute, The Replacements covered Black Diamond?
Like, oh, I know.
On a studio album? Like, how cool is that? Then they started getting validated, right, by other bands
right.
that you liked.
Right.
There were other people that, like, were into it just like we were.
Right.
You know, and they made it cooler.
Yeah, and it was, you suddenly realize that, like, all the bands had... You know, there were a lot more of them were into Kiss, and you know, and I'm not going to say that there are Velvet Underground, you know, but I wanted to be up on stage with them. I grew up on Simon Garfunkel and Paul Simon. My parents were really into that. But right at this point, what was happening? There was two parts. There was rock and roll. And then off to the right, there came this thing called disco.
Yes.
And my mom was a dancer, loved to dance. Not a dance. I shouldn't say that. It was in dance contests in the late 50s in high school and early 60s. And all. Fabulous dancer. She really was. Man, disco hit. And that's where I was going, can you guys just please go back to the Simon Garfunkel? Because my mom seriously played... The Saturday Night Fever soundtrack.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
A thousand times. There was a little bit of a friendly rivalry because I'm in my room and I've finally got a decent stereo and mm-hmm. I'm cranking Alive. I'm cranking, you know, Sweet and all this. And she's in there listening to the Bee Gees and she still loves the Bee Gees to this day. And I have a whole different respect for them. Anyway, but this is 70. Saturday Night Fever came out in 77, right? So this was the height of my you know, Kissdom. And there was this thing called disco. And Kiss couldn't be more anti-disco. And then you look and they're on the same label as Donna Summer. That's weird, you know. And
What do you want to hear from Alive, Bish? Let's hear a little something that you would pick.
Oh, well, I always like got to choose.
Okay.
And then but Nothing to Lose is another great song, but it's so offensive. I have to go with Got to Choose, you know.
Well, yeah, so. There is that. All right, let's hear a little bit of Got to Choose on Alive.
This whole time frame, I just go back and look at this and think about all that happened in these 2 years. They went from Kiss Alive,
right?
Kiss Alive in 75 to Kiss Alive 2 in October 77. I cannot believe that was just 2 years. That seemed 5 years, 6 years.
And I think, folks, in Bish's excitement is why you're going to want to listen all week. He's not giving away the story. He's just hinting at what's to come. What else about Alive, Bish? I mean... there's some dense kind of hard rock on this record, like where it's not so poppy. I mean, if you're listening to 100,000 Years, for example, or side three, let's talk about side three, Watching You, 100,000 Years in Black Diamond, right? That is a tough side of turgid rock and roll.
I always liked Black Diamond, but I'd skip the first three songs and go to it.
But of course, 100,000 Years does contain the drum solo.
You know, Peter Criss, he was really a pretty good drummer. And apparently
he was good at keeping a basic beat.
Well, but when you go back to the all the overdubs and stuff like that, none of the drums were overdubbed.
I mean, that's right. He's kind of like Ringo Starr in the Beatles, man. He just did what he needed to do. Right, he put some cool flourishes in there every now and then, but he was a real team player. He was like the guy.
And he probably had the best voice out of all.
Well,
if you were able to look at the etchings on my Kiss Alive record, I must have listened to side four 1,000 times more than I listened to side three. Side three is a tough listen.
You know, we should do, Bish, me and you, it'd be really interesting to, we did a couple episodes. I don't know if you heard them, where we cut double albums down to single albums. Just two episodes. We should probably do more. We did London Calling and we did Exile on Main Street.
I heard the Exile on Main Street. Yeah, you guys did London Calling.
Or something like that. Anyway, no, this would be a great one to cut down to one disc, right? You could make a great single album out of Alive. Now,
side one, side four. There, I'm done.
This was a single album. It would not have been as impactful because of what we talked about. You couldn't see the letters in the inside. You couldn't open it. You couldn't see the other albums. You couldn't hold it. And like, you know what I mean? Right. It had to be a double album because a Kiss concert was a big sprawling experience. This would not have worked as a single album.
Right. And that's why in a way, and I loved the album when it came out, but you wanted so much more. Cheap Trick at Budokan. God, I wish that had been a double album.
Well, there you go. That's a great example.
Now, maybe they said, well, let's put out a double album. Kiss did it. And then the record company said, no, let's just put it down to one. And that album's perfect, you know.
Kiss was not necessarily inventing anything, you know, completely new, right? But they were putting together the elements in exactly the right way at exactly the right time. And that's why you and I, as suburban kids, were such huge fans of this band, right? They figured it all out and put it together in a very smart way. But that's what I loved about them, because they made no pretension. I mean, Kiss was the most unpretentious band of all time. They were just like, hey, man, yeah, we want to be stars. We want to make money. We're putting makeup on and wearing costumes. Of course, we want to be huge rock stars. That's what we want.
They had the one hook. They had Rock and Roll All Night that kind of pulled people in.
Yep.
And then you got into the visual of it. You know, you sat there looking at the pictures. You had to listen to the music, and it was like a subliminal influence. And many years later, you know.
Yeah.
And I've never thought that you have written a riff, brought to the band a song riff that sounded like Kiss. I will say that.
Man, I never have.
But subliminally, we still have that influence. But again, that goes on to the idea, you know. So they were jumping around and they were missing chords and stuff like that. But how many times have you and I been to a show and said, well, the music was good, but man, they were boring. You know, they weren't jumping around.
Rock and roll. don't know, man. To me, it's like gut bucket rock and roll, you know, that just a, you know, maybe we're not technically good enough to, you know, put a lot of solos in, but they were doing the best they could. And just those little flourishes. I mean, it just, I don't know. You're right. I think, Bish, going back to what you said, they made you feel like you could be in a band. And, you know, when you're an 11-year-old kid, they definitely did.
Kiss could not have existed anywhere else but America. I mean, honestly, it couldn't have. That gut bucket.
Totally, man.
That workman
yep.
ship like or whatever. Because right. those guys.
Because they went on the road. They worked their asses off every day to make the band successful.
They did. They did.
Yeah.
They did. You know.
Bish, I want to say thank you. You know, for all your help, and God bless you. And in the name of the Father, Son, and Ace Frehley, I hope everything is fine. Anyway, any last thoughts before we sign off?
No, I keep coming back. I keep coming back to this thing that we didn't stand a chance, man.
Yeah, you're right.
We were yanked in, and we were brainwashed for yeah. those couple of years. Well, I wouldn't say brainwashed, but. But they knew exactly, somebody knew exactly what they were doing.
Right. And it was enjoyable. And it turned us on to rock and roll, too. You know, it gave us that foothold so we could take the next step. And I think
Peter
that's
Chris
so important.
Made me want to be a drummer.
Well, there you go.
And then I became a Rush fan and realized I could never be a really good drummer.
And then you join Wingtip Slip. That's another podcast, folks.
Yeah, that is another podcast.
But thank you, guys, everyone who has stuck around for this long. And just want to say, follow Rockin' the Suburbs. We're at SuburbsPod on all the social medias. If you want to email us, it's rock@suburbspod. If you want to send us a flaming arrow or a carrier pigeon, that's cool, too. You can send you can just always stick your head out the window and yell. That always works. So we're going to wrap this up. It was Kiss Alive, first salvo in Kiss Week, long promised, and now semi-delivered. We're going to sign off. I am Patrick Foster, and with me has been
Jimmy Page.
Good night, everybody. We'll talk to you tomorrow. We're all going to get together, smoke some angel dust, and watch Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park.
And that's going to be edited out.